At the micro level, there are things like perceptions. There are things like cultural, religious perceptions. And this speaks to the literacy, financial literacy, digital literacy of our population. And then, of course, there are important market incentives, market drivers, or lack of those drivers or gaps thereof, imperfections. What type of product you offer, the conditions you attach to those products so that they suit the people you are targeting, how you price it, and things like that. But overall, technology has played a big role. Although, of course, it doesn't fail to meet some challenges. Today, cybersecurity is an issue, data privacy, and things like that. But on the whole, those sort of speak to the enablers and drivers that make financial inclusion happen. In this part of the region, different countries are at different levels. In Uganda, for example, we have the National Financial Inclusion Strategy 2017-2022. And there were a couple of pillars, particularly to work on the barriers, to build digital infrastructure, broaden savings and investment, build that critical credit infrastructure, and of course, empower the individuals, the population from a literacy point of view. We've done well as a country. Expanded lots of channels, rolled out agent banking. We have eased the identification process, the national identity card process through e-models. We've had the National Payment Systems Act by the regulator to all create that environment and progress inclusion. So the what we call NFIS 1, the National Financial Inclusion Strategy 1, is over. We are now going to 2, NFIS 2, again speaking to increasing the various products, strengthening consumer protection, speaking to gender issues, the youth, and of course the green finance market that is being developed. In the country now, just giving you a Uganda case, about 6, 7 years ago, we had about 6 million accounts in the system. Today we have 24 million accounts. We had just under 1,000 branches. Today we have 30,000 bank agents spread across different parts of the country. The telecom sector has 472,000 agents spread across the country, and 34 million phone subscribers, or 37 million mobile money accounts. This has been a huge journey, and those people transact, trade beyond just sending money. Of course, there are issues of dormancy. Those also exist. Not all the accounts are active in the banking system. There are about 7 million accounts inactive. In the telco sector, there are about 11 million. But that has enabled reach. I know Kenya's success story is much huger. Huge, very huge. All the entire population literally trades on these various channels and platforms, up to the lowest level. Our mamas selling mboga and down there traveling. This is a big movement. This is transformation. And a lot of the digital credit now happening, digital lending. Here, over the last 6, 7 years, we've lent about 6 trillion on those small mobile loans on the phone, supporting nearly 13 million individuals or daily on small amounts they trade with. Half a million of them are small SMEs, powering the economy across every other day. So this speaks really volumes. And from a national point of view, Kenya, I think, is way above the 84% inclusion mark. Rwanda is another success story, moving from 77 to over 83. In fact, in some of the regions, it's 90%. Tanzania at about 66%. Uganda, we've moved from about 54, we are around about 58%. So clearly, there's been a journey, but there is a lot more to do. Like I said, it's a journey, and we have to have more and more strategies to continue this success story, which is really the theme, the gist of this particular conversation this morning. So, like I said, financial inclusion is a policy goal for these parts of the world, and that means beyond the technology and efforts of financial institutions, governments must have economic empowerment programs, because where there's economic activity, there's bound to be more transaction, more activity. And in Uganda, there are many social programs that are targeted by government, the latest one being the parish development model. But we also have to work on the infrastructure to enable reach, especially network coverage. But even things like energy, you'll be surprised that in the rural areas, perhaps where the national electricity grid doesn't reach, if we have alternative forms of energy just to enable people to charge their phones, cool drinks in a fridge, you know, the economic activity starts peaking there and then. And you find that then transactions, even the originally excluded, get in there. I spoke to harmonizing policy frameworks, particularly fiscal policy. In this part of the world, we need to bring the bigger part of the population to the formal economy. And therefore, a tax policy that may work as a disincentive, either to importation of the technology or transactions, can impact and work on the success gained. We have continued to see regulatory interventions and support, like the central bank across the region is enabling sandboxes to test technology and therefore increase variety solutions 24/7. Those really must continue. And I want to thank the MNOs and fintechs that have helped this process. They've really brought services closer to the underserved, unserved part of the population and broken those barriers. The other strategy is really to use the last mile institutions, SACOs, VSLAs, cooperatives, MFIs, MDIs, microfinance institutions. These speak to the last mile, the vulnerable part of the population. They are closer, and the population listens to them. They hear them because they are within their communities. This is a powerful channel, a strong channel that reaches down there, and coupled with technology, they really play an important role, and we must continue to invest in them and strengthen them. They are very powerful intermediaries as much as possible. And of course, the real products that are then channeled, they must speak to the needs of that part of the population that you are targeting. That way it becomes relevant to support their businesses. And many financial institutions across the region. In Kenya, Equity Bank, I know, KCB, NCBA, Cooperative Bank, they've done a wonderful job in structuring products that speak to the needs of that person at the lowest level. In Uganda, many of our members are doing that. Centenary Bank is a good example of a range of products of different segments of the population. And as we get more and more formal, then you have opportunity to grow. In Uganda, last week I attended a session for the Uganda Registration Services Bureau, and they told us just about 500,000, their entire database of businesses registered is about 560,000. 500,000, that's not as big for an economy. But what registration does, it brings formality, it enables you then be able to compete for bigger businesses. The government here launched what we call a small business recovery program, especially after COVID, and availed funding through the financial system. But the uptake of that finance had challenges. For one thing, many of the would-be beneficiaries were unregistered businesses and are perceived to be high risk. So financial inclusion, really, this is where it speaks to regularizing businesses and bringing them in the formal system. And of course, the collaboration that we need to continue playing between the banks, the MNOs, the fintechs, and increasingly today they are impact funders, crowdfunding, bringing in the much needed finance on good terms and things like this. All this penetrate working through the channels I mentioned of MDIs, SACOs, to reach the population. And like I said, we must continue addressing the other imperfections. Today, digital lending has come with some problems. People are harassed. They have the database of your relatives, your mother. If you default, you can be embarrassed. I think those things can tend to discourage people, and we must work on them. So you can see that a combination of these strategies and continuous effort, like I said, it's a journey, are some of the things that will help us drive and continue driving financial inclusion. This is the only way we can leapfrog our economies in this part of the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Wilbrod, for your thoughts on the strategies going forward for financial inclusion, last mile institutions, policy harmonization, as well as dealing with emerging challenges around credit shaming. One of the questions which is emerging from the online platforms is, when you talk about the micro, small, and medium-sized businesses and want to get them into the formal financial inclusion, a very big challenge is around de-risking their borrowing. And the question being asked is, what is the role of entities such as credit guarantee schemes that we have seen, including what you've just mentioned around Uganda's small business recovery program? Could you give us some more context into that?
Thank you very much. Like I said, SMEs form the bulk that drives our GDP here. In this part of the world, we must focus on them as financial institutions. Yes, they are usually perceived as high risk because of their informality in nature. And guarantee frameworks play a very important role, because guarantees basically see that there's a risk, and the appetite of a financial institution towards those SMEs then becomes constrained because of the perceived risk. So what a guarantee essentially does is cushion the financial institution against that risk. So it then increases appetite to channel more and more credit. They play a huge role, and they'll continue to play a huge role as SMEs come out of informality and graduate to formality, to maintenance of records, sticking to the business they know. And it is envisaged that during that time, the financial institutions are understanding the SME, building stronger relationships to understand them more and grant them more access. So guarantees play a very, very important role. There are various providers across the region and in the market, and they cover different percentages based on the risk perception. But I think this is a good combination in addition, and they help, guarantees help with the challenge of collateral. Sometimes not everybody has collateral to put across against the borrowing. So guarantees, partial guarantees then give comfort to the financial institution to then own land. So that blend of combination of guarantees, collateral, good credit history continuously helps address the fears and perceived risk of financial institutions to enable them then extend more and more credit. And that's how credit grows, of course, with a good repayment history. Yes.
Thank you very much, Doctor, for that. Let me just remind those who are plugging in via the platform, you can get to the chat function and drop in your question. We'll be able to pick it from there and just voice it to our discussant here. That is Dr. Wilbrod. Meanwhile, there's a question emerging here around the role of financial literacy when it comes especially to the bottom of the pyramid, those guys who are not formally included yet, but yet they don't have the basic literacy around what is even required of them. What efforts can we put in place to address this challenge, sir?
Very spot on question. And as I was speaking to the barriers, literacy will remain critical, and we must continue to invest and do it and do it and do it. Because as I said, the challenges of information, even ability to use some of the digital gadgets, financial discipline, are important things. And therefore, continuing to invest in financial literacy is important, is how you address financial inclusion. Because then you provide knowledge and understanding of financial issues. You provide skills, the ability to use that knowledge. You provide confidence. Somebody is more confident. That must be supported by digital literacy these days to be able to safely use digitally delivered financial products. Just having confidence so that my grandmother, my auntie in the village is comfortable and knows what is charged, how they will access that money, how to use it, how to pay it back, the discipline required around that. Very important is in the mode of delivery of financial literacy. And like I said, institutions that are closer to the population, the customer segments and the people, listen to them more, they are more comfortable with them. When you deliver literacy programs through SACOs, through VSLAs, they believe them, they hear them. Things like entertainment, sometimes they are music stars, they are personalities who are popular, they have followers, people believe in them. School programs, films, demonstrations, are very, very important. And that's how you then provide clarity, guidance to the population, to consumers. Then you provide there some consumer protection so that they are confident, they have where to go to should they find challenges. So financial literacy is very, very critical. It plays a very, very important part. And there are many ways of delivering it beyond the formal ones. When we launched agent banking in Uganda, initially we first used to run high level radio, up there, billboards, and TV and so on. And it was clear we were not reaching down here. And therefore these institutions I mentioned and the mode of delivery so that it is believed, it is seen. When I see a neighbor impacted by these things, I have a better chance of following and doing it that way. Thank you.
Thank you for that response. We've got two questions here for you. First one is being asked by Kelvin Waiderero, who's asking, considering the attractive returns from government securities that are tax-free, I believe they have infrastructure bonds in mind here, why would banks be motivated to lend to SMEs? And second question from Juma Frederick is asking, registering SMEs and making them official is not a problem. The problem is government seeing them registered as an avenue to collect more taxes. Granted, everyone should pay their fair share of taxes, but the concern being raised here is within the MSMEs then shy away from formalization because of the taxation concerns. If you could respond to the two, please.
Thank you. Let me take the first one, that if instruments, government instruments are more attractive to financial institutions, you sit, put a placement in treasury bills, bonds, get a good return, sit back, why go into a high risk area where you are not sure, and then isn't it better to stay the other way? No, the role and mandate of a financial institution is financial intermediation. What does this mean? You collect savings and make those savings available to the economy for credit, and credit then expands an economy, and there are multiplier effects across the economy through markets, through manufacturing, through trading, and by extension that brings employment. That is the multiplier effect. And so a financial institution that would just sit and invest in treasury bills wouldn't be playing that intermediary role. But secondly, how will you get customers if you just have placements in the treasury? And it makes more sense when the amounts are big. But our population, the individuals out there, they need small amounts of money to expand their small businesses. And that's where intermediation then plays a role. Remember, they are the ones who bring these deposits. They in turn need to be supported by extension of credit to expand economic activity across. And therefore, yes, whereas it looks more attractive to just invest in instruments, you are not then playing the rightful role and mandate of financial intermediation. You may speak to risk, but then the job of a finance manager is to mitigate risks. And we spoke about guarantees and other frameworks, then to deal with those risks, expand that base of business so it grows. You cannot expand an economy by just dealing on treasury bills. Registration, you said registration is seen as a way of capturing information for then tax purposes. Again, this was a very interesting conversation we had like at the URSB conversation we're having recently. And the idea was that please address this as a methodology for bringing formality in business. Don't look at it only for tax purposes. And we've argued before with the Minister of Finance and the tax authorities and fiscal policy planners that you need to build a critical mass in the population of registered businesses. People doing businesses formally enable them grow and then prepare them later for tax. But if you start with a tax objective, you lose the wider picture and constrain the economy. Let people register, get formal, expand, have opportunities to do bigger businesses. The tax will come automatically. If you put the tax first, and this is something that is now being appreciated gradually, that it is better to build the critical mass first. The advantages that come with it, financial institutions are more comfortable lending to registered and formalized businesses. When you expand that base ultimately the tax will come rather than putting the tax first. And luckily, this is beginning to be appreciated.
On the businesses first. So Eric Mokaya from Mwango Capital is raising three questions here. The first one is, how are the issues with NPLs, non-performing loans, in Uganda compared to other East African countries? The second question is, what drives the lower inflation rate in Uganda compared to, say, Kenya? I have the answer to that, having covered Uganda before, but I'll leave it for you, Daktari. And third is, Kenya and soon Tanzania has tapped into the Eurobond markets. What are your reflections on that direction potentially being taken by Uganda? So three questions there from Eric Mokaya of Mwango Capital.
Thank you very much. The NPLs in Uganda are in the range of 5.8% or thereabouts, getting even lower. Across the region, I think we are fairly low. I know that other regions, some of the peer countries, are slightly higher. And it's driven by many things. The risk appetite, I would almost also say our lending book hasn't been growing. It has been not even as aggressive in the recent couple of years. Because, of course, you are seeing how the economy is recovering. How has this been managed? Not just being conservative. Of course, a huge part of the lending is collateral-based lending, and therefore there's caution to try and secure the property pledge. But most importantly, the underlying businesses are beginning to recover. SMEs have found a way, have a certain way of resilience, by the way, that if this is quickly not working, I need to shift to something else so that I'll get the cash flows to pay back the facilities. But of course, there are also aggressive measures. And there's been restructuring of facilities to accommodate the challenges that borrowers have had in this region. So a combination of that has helped the percentages comparably across compared to the region. And we are seeing that if the economy continues to improve, those numbers should come down, especially with the growth of credit, more lending going out there. Low inflation in Uganda. A couple of things, but first and foremost, food inflation is not something that is a big problem in Uganda. We have food, and you know, food is life, first and foremost. That's the basic. We have plenty of food across. We have had good weather, and therefore the prices of food have generally not been going upwards. From an imported inflation point of view, yes, sometimes obviously fuel drives a lot of the inflation, but even when it has come up, and it has been cushioned by the nearly no movement in increasing food prices, and that has helped us. And of course, the wider macros in the economy, in terms of management of fiscal policy and monetary policy, and has kept interest rates low, and expenditure management and the fiscal discipline. That has really collectively helped the country steer to these levels of stability. Across the region, different countries have different challenges. We know the challenges Kenya is facing. We believe that they will eventually be put behind and the economy stabilizes as we go along. The question of Eurobonds is a tricky one. Different countries have different needs, and as such, they source money differently. We have seen in some of the countries that if not well managed, it can run a country into big problems when there are maturities, when there are exchange rate fluctuations, and more importantly, what the money was then used for, how well it was used to bring the intended multiplier effects. So there are lessons we are seeing across. In Uganda, we are trying to be careful for the time being and using other sources because of what we are seeing in the region. But we would like to see that across our sister countries, because we depend on each other quite a bit, that those things by themselves don't bring about the turmoil across the economy.
Thank you very much for that response. Clearly, abundance of caution is quite important there. Speaking about financial inclusion, Charles Kimoyo is asking, how best can banks be more accommodative to agribusiness financing, and why are banks apparently slow when it comes to lending to agribusiness ventures?
Okay, typically, I think it has been a perceived risk for the agricultural sector. The top sectors, for example, in Uganda, here trade comes first, manufacturing, then the personal loans, sorry, real estate comes first, and then trade, manufacturing, then the personal lending. So agriculture or agribusiness has been down at the bottom. But when you think about it carefully, most of the businesses are agri-based anyway. So perhaps sometimes the coding of agribusinesses goes into other sectors. But historically, there has been a perceived risk seen by lenders in the agricultural sector because of the seasonality aspects, price fluctuations, quality issues, and things like that. And therefore, there has been reluctance. So as and when there's lending, it is anchored or premised on lots of guarantee frameworks and assured off-takers who will then generate the cash flow for the borrowers. Increasingly, this is changing because we realize that this is really the core of our economy. And we must navigate and circumvent, find ways of dealing with the challenges. And this is where guarantee frameworks come in, but also following the cash flow and the production cycles and dealing with the underlying issues of the quality, post-harvest losses, the pricing, the transportation, the assurance in yields as this come and technology is beginning to help. So increasingly we are seeing the agribusiness portfolios increasing. Like I said earlier, in some of the other countries, Kenya being one of them, we have understood these cycles very well. Of course, the agriculture base is quite organized in Kenya, and they're able to follow the cycles of business across that business space, structure products that speak to those segments. And I think the agribusiness portfolio consequently in Kenya is much bigger. We have lessons that we are seeing and learning. Some of those players, they are now regional players, they're in this market, and they are bringing those insights and products to this particular market. There are also lots of guarantee frameworks in the agribusiness space taking shape here. The government by itself has got an agricultural credit facility, which has cushions built around it so that we see more lending directed in the agribusiness sector. I think it's a journey. There's learning for the institutions by themselves. There are, of course, the players themselves that certain things that need to be done to improve their business and bring the confidence. And of course, the supporting institutions that provide the guarantee frameworks and support across the agribusiness space itself. But that's really the gist of our economy. We can't run away from it, and we must continue finding ways and means of supporting agribusiness across.
There's a question around, how does gender impact financial inclusion in East Africa, and what initiatives are in place to address gender disparities in access to financial services?
Thank you very much. Again, using our country, we have a higher population. I think 52% are women. And so gender really becomes central. If 52% of the population are women, 48% are men. How is that the gender side of things? How do solutions speak to women? What products, services are there for them? How involved are they in economic activities across the country? It affects financial inclusion if those specific segments of the population, 52%, are not being addressed or targeted with the financial interventions. It obviously has a bearing if 52% is not well targeted, especially in the rural areas. And therefore, policies that drive financial inclusion must have a gender lens embedded in them, because then they speak to that significant part of the population. And beyond that, trace what are the activities they're involved in? What are their challenges? What are the bottlenecks stopping them from being active in business, in productive activity, to transact, to generate income? Are there cultural stereotypes Are they disadvantaged from a collateral point of view? Are they allowed to business? So beyond the financial aspects, there are socioeconomic aspects that you must deal with. But in addition, specific products targeted to women to address those gender gaps, very, very critical. Many of our financial institutions now have several products for women. We are not necessarily there yet, but I think the journey is good. The government has policies that sort of directed to ensure there's representation at the decision table, whether in parliament, in local councils, in our organizations, in the banking sector. The percentage of the country is almost the same reflected. We have slightly more women. However, they rise in rank. The number reduces from supervisory to senior management to the CEO level. It starts becoming a triangle. Not an issue. Yes, an issue, but I think it can be dealt with those who are there and how much do we empower even those below to make sure they are at the decision table, their products address gender needs, they are increasingly empowered with the decision-making capabilities so that those interests, their products that serve those gaps and empower them are more and more embedded in the financial system and the economy as a whole. So yes, obviously gender has a huge bearing to financial inclusion, and there must be targeted interventions that address those particular gaps.
For that, our next question focuses on what are the potential risks and benefits associated with the rapid adoption of digital financial services in Africa? I know you have previously touched on this, but maybe just respond to this one too.
There are many, and for me, I am very, very optimistic. I start from an optimistic point. First of all, technology has broken boundaries and barriers like never before. And for that, we must safeguard that, even if there are risks that come with it. There are risks, yes. First of all, there are cyber risks, and these days people invest in cyber 24/7, fraudsters, to trick, to rob, to deny service, and cause financial losses to users, to institutions across the board. And that means we must continue investing in cyber defense capabilities and resilience therein to minimize and ensure that that doesn't take away the otherwise good. The second one is the risk of data breaches. In this process, technology, people are dealing with a lot of information and data, and that can be manipulated to the disadvantage of would-be beneficiaries. And that is a huge risk. Across our economies, they have put in place measures to try and deal with, you know, data breaches and things like that, and penalties for when there's a breach established, and duty of care and responsibility for data processors, for data custodians, to minimize this. So that's a risk. Like I was telling you, if I am borrowing a digital lender, and before they give me money, they want to know all my friends, all my relatives, my location, geolocation, so that if I default, my girlfriend, my priest, my church, my wife, my nearby Duka guy, everybody knows I've defaulted, and my God, I better pay the loan or else I have no standing. And so even there are dignity risks that start coming into play. So yes, cybersecurity, data privacy, there are issues around connectivity, of course, in some areas, but those are matters that can be dealt with. The other issue is about interoperability. There are numerous systems and solutions currently, and their ability to be connected so that in whichever platform I'm in, I can link up is important. So interoperability will be critical, and by extension, once that happens, the issues of affordability are addressed then, because then if you have mass volumes and economies of scale, the cost of services become cheaper. And lastly, of course, is just digital literacy. Remember that if you are not good at these things, you can be taken advantage of. So it's important that we invest in digital literacy so that they are not just knowing how to use it, but they are confident that they use it well and that the solutions that they see in these platforms actually address their needs. So those are just some of the way I see it.
Mr. Wilbrod, there's a question on Twitter which is very interesting, and this gentleman is asking, is there room for collaboration between financial services players like banks and SACCOs to deepen financial inclusion? Often it looks like you're being viewed as competitors. What do you see as a room for collaboration?
Absolutely wonderful question. There is a lot of room, plenty of room, and frankly, that's the way it should be. Remember when I spoke earlier, I said the last mile institutions are those closest to the underserved and served. So there must be collaboration with them because one, they reach the population. Two, they understand the needs of those that population. When I'm a tier one bank, I have larger, wider vision. Perhaps I lend in big amounts. As I go lower the chain, the amounts start getting smaller. And the best vehicles are those that then break those numbers, the lending. I can lend on a daily basis. I lend to you. You go and buy mboga, sell it, pay back in the evening. Banks lend for longer period. The best placed vehicle institution is at that point, the SACCO, the VSLA, the MFI, the MDI. But also too, they are then the institutions that are better able to manage the funding for you. Because then if you're a tier one, you can't deal with millions of small borrowers. Of course you can with through technology, but then you are not closer to them from a relationship point of view. And these then become the institutions that are closer. And technology has enabled that. So there is every reason for collaboration because everybody then brings and adds value. And frankly, there's enough business for everybody. Because if I then own lend the lower, smaller institution, and then they in turn lend the final last mile customer, we are all benefiting, okay? So the myth of saying we are competitors is wrong. It's very, very wrong. It doesn't see the full picture. Today, more than ever, collaboration and partnerships is the way we deliver solutions. And it has huge multiplier effect. Our tagline as UBA is partnerships and collaborations. So mine is a firm yes, that collaboration is there and must happen and we must foster it.
We're in the last 10 minutes of our discussion, so let me just pick some very quick questions here. One is, are there cultural factors that influence the adoption of financial services across the region, and how can this be addressed to enhance financial inclusion?
Yes, you remember when I was speaking about some of the barriers, the religious, cultural, there are societies that say, I don't deal with formal financial institutions. They're asking you for too much. You don't know what they're doing. And so, yes, very, very much so, regrettably. I think really the way we must deal with this is continuous literacy. You remember I said it's a process. We must continue educating and showing benefits that come with formal systems, with financial inclusion. And when you see you believe, when you see that because this person took that step, he or she is better off, is more empowered economically, is a better direction. And therefore must continue investing in financial literacy in different ways, in different languages, in using different media to reach and break those cultural, religious, those that constrain people from coming into a formal economy. The countries that are developed, the developed economies, what is driving them is just the presence of a powerful middle class that has money to spend, disposable income. And that alone just generates more and more economic activity by creating aggregate demand. If you are down there, you have your cultural beliefs, you don't have money, you're not in the formal economy, you are staying away and indeed not just doing a disservice to yourself, but to the economy as well.
Yeah. He's asking, what's your view on the use of credit ratings in addressing the gap in assessing risk of financing to SMEs in East Africa? So essentially your thoughts around financial inclusion and the role of credit rating agencies.
Credit rating is a tool that you use, obviously, to make a lending judgment. And that it determines how much, how I price, the terms. Indeed, it determines even whether I have appetite to lend to a particular segment or sector or customer. So it's an important tool, and it's usually derived at, by looking at behaviors and certain indices. So it's an important thing. It tends to work very well from a uniform borrower base. If the borrowers are the same, the lending amounts are fairly small. But even big lending, rating is important because you are looking at the capacity and ability to pay back. Remember, every lending, you want the loan or facility to be paid back. So it's very important because it brings confidence and it enables a lender position themselves as to how they want to lend you. A good credit rating obviously automatically means more credit, and the lower or poor credit scores mean the reverse. So I think it's an important tool because then it simplifies lending and decision making. It classifies and categorizes good and good, medium, poor borrowers or payers. It's a very, very important tool. I think what is important is once the ratings are observed, what is done about them. And that requires also educating the borrowers and the population that this rating means this. When you have a good rating, you can get a good loan price, you get better terms. Really, typically, usually, is ability to pay back. Pay back well, you have opportunity to get a better price, you have opportunity to get more money, you can borrow longer tenures, it helps. At the lowest level, as I said, it tends to generalize categories, but really it's been arrived at based on empirical studies to see that certain segments, this is the behavior and they attract such and such a score. It's a tool that we continue perfecting as we see, as we do studies, but yes, very, very important. It tells a lot about a borrower.
Mr. Wilbrod, as we wrap up the conversation, the question is being asked about the role of fintech in formal financial inclusion. You mentioned this briefly earlier. Just give us some more perspective into it.
Oh, I have passion in this area. Fintechs have really, as I said, take this away if there's anything. They have broken barriers. They've enabled us to reach markets we would never have reached 24/7 with solutions that we previously delivered through a physical branch very far away from people. We used to close at 2, we extended to 5 o'clock. It's 24/7, it's simple. They have played a very, very big role. They are partners. When you speak to collaboration, they have changed the landscape of the financial sector. And technology is driving this change, and fintechs play an important role. In some of the jurisdictions, of course, they differ in size, and that can sometimes bring elements of risk because there are standard risk requirements in managing finances. Because some are small, they sometimes do not embed the risk frameworks. But those are transitionary provisions. As they grow, as they integrate with formal financial institutions, the standards start coming in. As a financial sector, we work very closely. The Uganda Bankers Association works very closely with what we call here FITSPA. FITSPA is the Financial Technology Service Providers Association. And under that umbrella, there are numerous fintechs. Some of them have graduated to being licensed by the central bank as payment service providers. They are an important component and partners for financial institutions in delivering solutions, not just technology, but last mile. And we continue to form that collaboration. Again, like in the past, initially some thought they were competitive.
We have
in the financial space.
3 minutes to go. So let me invite you just to make your closing thoughts around the subject of strategies for deepening financial inclusion, focusing on Uganda and East Africa at large, and what we can do as both players in the public and private sector to advance this agenda.
Thank you very much. First of all, this was a wonderful session. I think there is a role for everybody to play. Private sector players, and that cuts across, not just financial institutions or fintechs like I was speaking to. There are public policy, public sector bodies from a policy point of view, from enabling environment, from infrastructure. There are development partner agencies that have helped. I spoke to crowdfunding, but also benchmark studies of how it has worked in other markets. So there's a role for everybody. Like I said, financial inclusion is a development index. It's a journey. There is still work to be done, but we have seen success stories across the region. And this is really the only way in this part of the world we can leapfrog and develop our economies, knowing how it is formed. So I want to really thank you. I thank you, KBA. I thank you, Julians. I thank my counterparts in Rwanda and Tanzania. And of course, the entire audience that has been very, very engaging. I've liked the discussions very much. Thank you.
Thanks to our guest speaker this morning, that is Mr. Wilbrod Humphreys-Owuor, Executive Director, Uganda's Bankers Association. Thank you so much for your insights, running through a raft of issues from policy interventions, the role of fintech, the role of credit rating agencies, the macro environment, and also giving us nuggets on last mile institutions and the areas of collaboration between players in the financial services ecosystem. Thank you so much for that. Thank you to our audience for fielding very informative and enlightening questions. We have really gained a lot from this, and we'll still continue to churn out this knowledge because this is why we hold this sort of platforms. I'd like to remind everyone that on Monday next week, we will be carrying on with this series of conversation now with the CEO of the Kenya Bankers Association, Dr. Habil Olaka, and we'll be discussing the subject of green finance with a focus on banking sector in East Africa. So ensure you dial in for that conversation. It will be quite illuminating as well. So make a date with us. We shall be here to continue with this agenda of fostering the role of the banking sector in East Africa's economy. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let's do this again on Monday at the same time.
Thank you. Thank you, Raj.
Thank you, team.
Thank you. Thank you very much.